Thanks for the introduction. Yeah, so as Luis said, I'm going to try to convince you that spinning black holes are a good tool to do gravity and also cosmology. So I'll start with a brief outline of the talk. In the first part, I'll try to convince you exactly of the point I just made by giving a few examples of why black hole spins are important in gravity, in cosmology, and in astrophysics. So I'll go through a number of these examples because they will be the basis, well, the topics I will tackle in the second part of my talk and in the third part of my talk. So more in detail, in the second part of the talk, I will talk about how we can include the effect of the spins, of the black hole spins in the waveforms, which is something which is needed for LIGO and future gravitational wave detectors as well. And in particular, I will talk about the effective one-body model. Whereas in the third part of the talk, I will talk about the evolution of the massive black hole spins in the cosmological framework. So I'll try to convince you that it doesn't make sense to study black hole spins independently of their host galaxy. So hopefully I'll convince you of this, and I will derive implications of this fact for future gravitational wave detectors such as LISA. And many of you might think that LISA will never fly, but right in these days, I heard news from Luis, actually, who claimed that he heard rumors that LISA might actually be flying soon. Actually, there is a call, an ESA call this year, and LISA might have good chances. So this is a good time to study black hole spins in the context of LISA. So first of all, why are we interested in black hole spins? So we know that spins are important in the case of isolated black holes because of what is called the frame dragging effect. So essentially, this amounts to saying that the ISCO, the innermost stable circular orbit, depends on the spin. So the ISCO moves inwards when you increase the spin. And this is a fact which is not only of academic importance because it has implications in astrophysics because it regulates the efficiency of thin accretion disks. So the efficiency of thin accretion disks increases as you increase the spin of the black hole, and it tops at 42% for an extremal black hole. And this is something that you can test with the X-ray data in astrophysics. However, the same effect, frame dragging effect, also acts in the case of binary black holes, although it's sometimes less recognized. And this goes under a different name. It's sometimes called spin orbit coupling or hang up effect, but it's essentially the same thing. So if you have a system of two black holes with spins pointing out of the screen and orbital angular momentum pointing inwards, so misaligned spins pointing up and orbital angular momentum pointing down, you find that if you do a numerical simulation, you find that your binary describes only a few cycles before plunging. Whereas if you're in the case in which the spins are in the same direction as the orbital angular momentum, the effective innermost stable circular orbit of the system moves inwards. So your binary describes many cycles before eventually plunging. And this is the same effect as I described in the case of isolated black holes, because it's the position of the effective ISCO that matters when it comes to deciding whether the binary plunges or not. This is exactly the same effect, and it has implications, of course, for gravitational waves, because if a binary describes many cycles before plunging, it emits a lot of gravitational waves, whereas if the ISCO is at large radii, it emits less energy in gravitational waves. So this amounts to saying that the gravitational wave emission depends strongly on the spin. In fact, if you plot the final mass of a binary system, which is, of course, an indication of how energy is lost in gravitational waves versus the spins of the black holes involved, in general, you find that high spins corresponds to more energy emitted in gravitational waves. And this is, again, the same effect, frame dragging effect, that we saw in the case of isolated black hole. Just in this case, it's testable with gravitational wave detectors. And of course, we know today that we have gravitational wave detectors such as LIGO, which will measure black hole spins to very high accuracy in the case of stellar masses, stellar mass black holes. But also, as I was saying, we have future gravitational wave detectors, which might be online at some point in the next 20 years, hopefully. So one is LISA, and the other, for instance, we have ground-based gravitational wave detectors, such as the Einstein telescope, which will be sensitive to other mass ranges for black holes, not only stellar mass black holes, but also supermassive black holes and intermediate mass black holes.
I'm sorry.
2020 is here.
That's soon
for me. It's soon. Depends on your point of view. I mean, sure. We need to have LISA science done before LISA flies, of course. By cosmological standard, yeah, it's less than the Hubble time.
Can I ask a quick question about just going back a couple of slides to this? Just a general question, I wonder if you know about it. Am I correct that those all rely on modeling the disk as a thorn mode? Model that the internet is really quick to the ESCO?
Yeah, so that's what it...
Have people simulated and just... So it ultimately boils down to the fact that the ESCO depends very heavily on
the
internet. Have people actually done numerical simulations of actual disks near the extremal limit and seen whether anything in the actual simulations depends so sharply?
Yeah, that's a good question. I know I think they can do those simulations, but I'm not sure about what results they have. I don't see any point why they shouldn't be able to go to high spins. Maybe just the resolution, because when you have a high spin, the ESCO gets closer to the horizon in the
scoring. Maybe. Obviously, the ESCO being an internet is kind of a practice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, yeah, they people study. Yeah,
sharp,
no, yeah.
Very sharp dependence.
Yeah, so the McClintock and the Harvard group, they did, so because the thin disk approximation is what they use to measure the spins in the case of a continuum fitting, and they checked whether their results depend on the thin disk approximation, so they actually consider black disks which have a certain extent, vertical size, and they found that the results don't depend strongly on the thin disk assumption, so that's what they claim, but honestly, I don't know the details, and I'm not sure if they looked at the very high spins. But I would be surprised if things changed very much. I mean, right? Because I would be surprised because they say that their results are independent of the thin disk assumption, and they can measure when they measure spin with the continuum fitting method. They go to very high spins, not to one, of course, but to 0.9 something.
It's the thin disk assumption and then the assumption that it terminates.
But they don't have when they do a numerical simulation. They don't have this assumption,
right.
So their disk extends inside the ESCO.
Oh, you mean that's what they're.
In their simulations. So I'm not sure which spin they considered, but I'm sure they went to high spins. Yeah, so the other process I want to talk about before going to the core of the talk is the so-called Bardeen-Peterson effect. And this is another place where the frame dragging of the black hole plays a role. So essentially, the Bardeen-Peterson effect deals with a black hole, which has a certain spin in the vertical direction, and the misaligned disk, which does not lie on the equatorial plane of the black hole. So essentially what happens is that the interaction between the frame dragging, the spin orbit coupling of the black hole, and the viscosity of the disk essentially warps the inner part of the accretion flow. So you end up very quickly with a disk which is misaligned far from the black hole and aligned near the black hole. And on a longer time scale, again, the interaction due to the viscous forces, the warp propagates out, and by Newton's third law, the black hole spin tilts and eventually aligns with the orbital angular momentum. So what the Bardeen-Peterson effect tells you is that if you have a misaligned disk around the black hole, in a very short astrophysical scale, which is 10 to the 5 years for massive black holes, the spin of the black hole aligns with the orbital angular momentum of the disk. So no misaligned disks are expected. In most cases, you don't expect misaligned disks. And this is, again, something which is very important for gravitational wave detectors.
So, I mean, I think we had a few talks here saying the opposite.
It depends. Yeah, I mean, the Bardeen-Peterson effect, there are no full GR simulations which show the Bardeen-Peterson effect. Bardeen-Peterson effect depends on the geometry of the disk. If it's a thin disk, a slim disk, a thick disk, things might change. Maybe that's what...
I think maybe this happens for thin disk, but if it's not, the disk is not very thin,
then
this doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, I don't doubt that. Yeah, in fact, if the disk is not, it depends on the height of the disk over the.
Because I guess the point is that there's a time scale for alignment, but if you fall in before that happens, then you don't have time.
Oh, you're thinking about a binary? Yeah.
No, just talking about the disk, right? So the disk is rotating. So
yeah.
There's a time scale for alignment and there's a time scale for
It also depends on the viscosity of the disk, of course. If the disk has no viscosity, you have no Bardeen-Peterson effect whatsoever because you can't dissipate. I mean, you can't, as I said, it's a combination of the frame dragging and the viscosity of the disk. If you had a disk with no viscosity, you can't have anything.
Yeah, but I mean, the effect I'm talking about, viscosity is important for infall and viscosity is important for alignment.
Yep.
But the point is that you want the alignment to happen before the infall happens. Otherwise, you don't have alignment. You fall before you align. And I think that's That's kind of my recollection. Because I think there are a couple of simulations.
Okay. I know there are simulations of, by CRISPR Agile in which they find this effect. I've never looked exactly at what. CRISPR Agile. He has simulations in which they show the effect. There are other claims by Lodato and Tyring et al. In which they claim that if the geometry of the disk is not a thin disk, then the alignment is less important. Things also depend on the equation of state of the disk. And this is something that people showed. If you have a hot equation of state for the disk, it depends on the polytropic gamma of the disk. So if you have a hot equation of state, the alignment is to within, I don't know, 30 degrees, whereas if you have a hot, a cold equation of state, it's 10 degrees. There are many, it does depend on the disk. But I'm happy to talk later. Maybe you can point out exactly what is the process you had in mind, because I'm not sure I understand. So,
well, I mean, I think it's just what I said, is that you have a timer step alignment and a timer step for info, and if info happens before alignment, then alignment doesn't happen.
Info what? Info of the matter on the black hole?
Yeah.
Okay, I think it amounts to saying that the thing depends on the viscosity.
I think it's the same thing as you're saying.
Anyway, the point I want to make in this talk is that if we believe Berlin-Peterson, which is a big if you want, this has a big implication for gravitational waves, because if you have a gravitational wave, if you have a black hole binary in which the spins of the two black holes are aligned as a consequence of the Berlin-Peterson effect, the amplitude of gravitational waves shows no modulation. So here I'm plotting, these are post-Newtonian waveforms. This is the amplitude of the dominant mode versus essentially the frequency. And these are the black lines are waveforms for anti-aligned spins, non-spinning black holes, aligned spins. And as you see, there are no modulations. Whereas if you have spins that are not aligned, in general, they precess in post-Newtonian theory. And so you see all these modulations in the waveforms, actually in the amplitude. And this is something that gravitational wave detectors will be able to pick up, at least in the case of LISA. And the reason why I think this is important is that because this will tell us something about the gas content of galactic centers if we believe the Berlin-Peterson effect. Because if you have a binary, think of a supermassive black hole binary which merges in a very wet environment in which you have a lot of gas, then you would expect the Berlin-Peterson effect to align the spins of the two black holes with the orbital angular momentum of the disk. So by the time the binary merges, the spins will be aligned. So you'll fall in this category. Whereas if you are in a dry environment in which there is not much gas in the galactic center, you expect the spins to precess, because the Berlin-Peterson effect will be will not be active, essentially. So gravitational wave detectors, in particular LISA, will be able to tell us something about the gas content of a galactic center.
So that's also confusing. Now, I can see how this could be aligned with the spin of the black hole. But for the black hole to align itself with the disk, that's going to take longer time.
It takes 10 to the 5 years.
So I think it takes 10 to the 8 years, because you need to change the mass of the black hole.
No, it's not accretion onto the black hole. That's the point. It's much less than the Salpeter time scale. It's not the matter accreted on the black hole. It's the torque exerted by the disk on the black hole. So the magnitude of the spin doesn't change. It just tilts. So it's like Newton's third law. So the black hole exerts a torque on the disk, and it warps the disk, and the warp exerts a torque on the black hole spin. So it's not accretion timescale. That's the point. It's less than the accretion timescale.
Because the mass doesn't change very much by this spin.
I'm sorry. The mass doesn't change. No, doesn't change very much. No. Yeah. So the.
I think now. Correct me if I'm wrong. You may know, but I vaguely have this idea that Mike Kesson wrote a paper that said that just post-Newtonian equations.
Yeah, but it's not as efficient. Yeah, there are some resonances, but they're not as efficient.
Was it talking about resonance? I thought he was maybe just saying that alignment was an attractor. So that as you inspire just a gravitational wave emission.
Yeah, just gravitational wave emission, even in a dry environment, you can align the spins somewhat, but it's not the perfect alignment.
Okay.
I'll talk about this in the second part of the talk. I'm trying to include this effect in my models. This was just the introductory part, which was supposed to take 5 minutes. Anyway, so the last thing I'll talk about in this talk, namely in the second part, is the role of black hole spins in galaxy formation. So this is another area where black hole spins are important. And naively, you would think black holes should play absolutely no role in cosmology. because the scales of the event horizon of a black hole, even in the case of a massive black hole, are 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 7 parsecs, which are much less than the galactic time scale. So the black hole lives on subparsec scale, whereas galaxies live on kiloparsec or megaparsec scale. However, you you know this already, but let me remind you that we see these things that we call AGN jets that in galactic centers. So we see these beautiful jets that seem to arise from a point-like source in the galactic center. And these jets, they extend far into the galaxy and they're thought to transfer a lot of energy into galaxies and quench star formation because they transfer a lot of energy to the gas of the galaxy, so they prevent the gas from cooling and forming stars. And this is what people call the AGN feedback. And the nice thing is that we think that these jets are actually generated by black holes. So there is this old proposal, this old model proposed by Blensford and Snipe in 1977, according to which jets can be produced by a spinning black hole immersed in an external magnetic field. There are more recent proposals, including one by Lewis, according to which you can form jets also by using non-spinning black holes moving in an external magnetic field, which is thought to be anchored to the circumbinary disk. So the details maybe haven't been figured out yet, but we think there is a relation between jets and black holes, and therefore it doesn't really make sense to study black holes in galaxies independently of their host galaxies. Because on the one hand, the galaxy provides the fuel for the black holes to grow, provides the accretion material. And on the other hand, the black holes exert the feedback on the galaxy by means of the jets. So this is called AGN feedback, and it's actually one of the main ingredients of galaxy formation models because it serves to, it's used to explain the so-called cosmic downsizing. But maybe I'll skip that. So by now, I hope I'll have convinced you that studying black hole spins is important. So I'll now go into the details of some of my work. So first, I'll talk about how to include the black hole spins in the gravitational waveforms. And this is work that I did with a number of people, but mainly with Alessandro Bonanno's group at the University of Maryland. So what we want to do is to solve the two-body problem in GR. And as you know, in GR, you can't solve the two-body problem exactly, like in Newtonian mechanics, but you can use numerical relativity, which can actually solve the problem exactly up to numerical errors. However, the problem with numerical relativity is that it can cover only certain binaries, so binaries that either have comparable masses, essentially, or separations that are less than, say, 10 Schwarzschild radii, 10m. So numerical relativity in a mass ratio compactness diagram can only cover this corner. And if we want to move outside this corner, we have to use approximate solutions to the two-body problem. One is the post-Newtonian theory, which can cover any mass ratio, but breaks down when the binary becomes too close. And we have perturbation theory, or the self-force formalism, which is essentially an expansion in the mass ratio. So it's valid for any separation, but breaks down when the masses of the two black holes become comparable. So what I want to talk today is a way of taking information from each one of these three regimes and construct a phenomenological model for the dynamics and the emission from binary black holes. And this is called the effective one-body formalism. So the motivations, again, is to understand the two-body problem, but there is also a practical motivation, which is to produce fast and accurate templates for gravitational wave detectors, because numerical activity alone cannot do this task, because it cannot cover the whole parameter space. And it also, it's very slow to run a black hole binary on numerical relativity code. With numerical relativity code, it takes weeks or days. So the main idea of the two-body formalism is to map the comparable binary that we want to study into a test particle problem. So this is, of course, what we do in Newtonian mechanics all the time. So if we want to study a comparable binary, we take simply the reduced mass of the system and place it around the total mass, a body with the total mass of the system, and that does the trick. And to some extent, you can do something similar, though only approximately, in QED. So in the 70s, people calculated the energy levels of positronium, which is a comparable mass system. And they showed that the energy levels of positronium are actually related to the energy levels of a hydrogen atom by a very simple relation. So essentially, the energy levels of hydrogen are the square of the energy levels of positronium. Essentially. So this, of course, means nothing because it's not clear that you can do such a construction in GR. But it turned out that you can actually do it in post-Newtonian theory in the case of non-spinning black holes. And this is what Buonanno and Damour showed in the end of the 90s.
Sorry, did you actually show that formula? Oh, here it is. Sorry.
So, yeah, what?
I see. I mean, this is basically the same formula.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is the same formula as I'll come to in a minute. So what these people did was essentially to consider the real binary that they want to study in post-Newtonian theory, so a comparable mass binary. So they wrote the Hamiltonian described in this binary in post-Newtonian theory. Well, they did a canonical transformation, but it's essentially the real Hamiltonian described in the system. And they tried to map this real Hamiltonian into an effective Hamiltonian describing a test particle moving around a deformed sparse black hole. And they gave this test particle, of course, the reduced mass of the system in order come because they want to reproduce Newtonian mechanics. And they found that if they choose the deformation of the sparse black hole properly, the relation between the effective Hamiltonian of the system and the real Hamiltonian from which they started is given by exactly by the same relation as in the case of hydrogen and positronium, up to the highest PN order which they could calculate, which was 3PN at that time. And now, well, this is simply.
Sorry, Victor, is that what you mean, the identical results?
Yeah. This order. Yeah, 3PN, this is the same relation as hydrogen and positronium. It's just verified also in PN theory to 3PN. Doesn't mean that it's valid at all PN orders, but this is a coincidence which cannot be ignored. Well, you can choose to ignore it, but so these people.
So could you say again, in what sense is that a code? So you don't mean that they had some totally independent way of defining H effective? So that it didn't have?
Well, H effective is the Hamiltonian of a particle in a generic space time, a deformed sparse black hole. So you need to choose the deformation of the sparse black hole to.
The deformation is basically
defined. But it's non-trivial to get this expression. If you try to have H effective equals to HPN real, whatever deformation you chose, you wouldn't be able to get that mapping. So they actually. They didn't know this relation between hydrogen and positronium when they wrote the paper. They just looked for a simple relation, quadratic relation, because they looked first at the linear relation. They tried to get H effective equals H real. They failed. And they showed that the simplest relation that you can get between H effective and H real, which you can reproduce with a given with a certain deformation of the sparse black hole, is this. And then they realized it had been found also in the case of hydrogen and positronium. So it's been, if you want, independent.
So basically, this would be if I would just write down in Newtonian gravity a two-body system in Newtonian gravity and go to effective description with this reduced mass mu, that's H effective.
Yeah, at the Newtonian level, yeah. I mean, if you expand this H effective at in post-Newtonian order and you only take the Newtonian order, you get the usual particle with reduced mass around the total mass. That's it. Yeah, so what you can do now, you know HPN real up to a certain PN order, and in principle, if you believe that this relation is valid at all post-Newtonian orders, so this is an extrapolation. If you believe that you can invert this relation and express H real essentially as the square root of H effective, and at this point, you can say H effective I know how to calculate, because it's the Hamiltonian of a particle in a deformed sparse black hole, so I know geodesics motion. I know how to write down the Hamiltonian for geodesics motion. So I get a model for H real, which is formally valid at all post-Newtonian order. And through 3PN order, which is the highest PN order at which we know this Hamiltonian, matches the initial post-Newtonian Hamiltonian. So this, if you want, the EOB is a way to extrapolate in post-Newtonian theory up to infinite order. An educated guess. It's a guess, but I think an educated guess.
So can you go back to the previous slide? So I guess a non-trivial thing is the square in E, right? In any E pop, is POS is positronium, right?
Positronium, yes.
So that's the square is the thing that's.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, if it was linear, I mean, all these masses are due to the fact that you want to subtract the masses of
but
the.
But those
electron.
Are just constants. So
they're just constants because you want to subtract the rest mass energy.
So the square part is the non-trivial.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I guess at the Newtonian level, you can expand the square. And
yeah, at the Newtonian level, you get simply a linear relation. Yeah. And when you go to higher post-Newtonian orders, you get the square. So in principle, what I want to do is to build an effective one-body model for spinning black holes. So in principle, you could do exactly the same thing. So you could start from the post-Newtonian Hamiltonian describing spinning black holes. And then you could try to match this with an effective Hamiltonian describing the motion of a spinning particle around a deformed Kerr black hole. And hopefully, if you choose the spin of the particle correctly, the deformation of the Kerr black hole correctly, and the spin of the Kerr black hole correctly, you'll get the same relation as before. And at that point, you'll be able to invert H real in terms of H effective, and therefore get a new B model for spinning particles. This is what we tried to do. This is the idea we had in mind. The reason why this is difficult is that in classical theory, it's not easy to write down the Hamiltonian describing the motion of a spinning particle in a generic curved background. So we know the equivalent of the geodesics equation for a non-spinning particle. In the case of a spinning particle, they become the Matheson-Papapetri equation. So you have deviations from geodesic motion due to the coupling between the spin of the particle and the curvature of the background. But we didn't know, at least until our work, the Hamiltonian describing this Papapetru equation. So what people did to construct the OB model for a spinning black hole was something a little bit dirty. So they tried to guess this Hamiltonian for a spinning particle based on post-Newtonian theory. But the guess was not was only the approximate answer. So as a result, the EOB model that they constructed didn't have the correct test particle limits, and this led to a long list of problems. So we wanted to improve upon that. And this is what we set out to do back in 2009, so quite a lot of time ago. So we tried to write down the Hamiltonian describing a spinning particle in general relativity. And it's a long calculation, and I'll just give the main idea. So what we started to do was to write down the action given the Papapetru equation. Unfortunately, that had been derived by Raphael Porter in 2006. And this action depended on the spin tensor, so it has 6 degrees of freedom for the spin. So they didn't impose a spin supplementary condition. So now I don't know if people know what the spin supplementary condition is, but it's essentially a way, it specifies the point with respect to which you define the angular momentum and therefore the spin of a spinning particle. So if you have a spinning particle, the spin is the angular momentum of the particle. Therefore, you have to specify the center of angular momentum with respect to which you calculate it. And this is why you have 6 degrees of freedom, 3 degrees of freedom for the spin, and 3 degrees of freedom for the position with respect to which you calculate the spin. But initially you have eventually to decrease these degrees of freedom, but initially we didn't do it, we just went ahead. So we introduced the time slicing and went from the action to the Lagrangian. So we were able to write down a Lagrangian which gives the Papapetru equation, but this Lagrangian still has 6 degrees of freedom for the spin. And at this point, we performed a Legendre transformation and derived the Hamiltonian, which still has 6 degrees of freedom for the spin, plus 6 degrees of freedom for the momenta conjugate to the spin. So we're even in a worse situation now. And at this point, in the Hamiltonian formalism, therefore in phase space, we imposed a spin supplementary condition to fix the center of angular momentum. And we also imposed another constraint to decrease the number of degrees of freedom of the momenta conjugate to the spin. And we found that if we choose the spin supplementary condition correctly by choosing a spin supplementary condition which is used in quantum theory, the Newton-Wigner spin supplementary condition, we get a canonical Hamiltonian. So we get a Hamiltonian for which the Hamilton equations take the usual form. And this Hamiltonian describes this is the Hamiltonian given the Papapetru equation.
Oh, you mean there's a unique choice for the spin supplementary?
Yeah, which gives a canonical. You can write the Hamiltonian using another spin supplementary condition, but then the anti-commutator of the spins will not be given by the usual Levi-Civita contracted with.
And what is it? Is it simple to say what the conditional
is? It's.
Is it this guy
TBUS? No, it's not. It's not any of those. It's. Now, I wish I had the slides. I I'm not sure I have this in the slides. Anyway, you introduce a, what you do, you introduce a tetrad field. At each, it's complicated. It's p mu nu plus something else, which is a tetrad field that you have to define to.
To define the time derivative.
Say again.
To specify. Is that dot there on x dot?
No, no, it's not. That's not dt. So this e is not dt. It's not the coordinate vector. It's a tetrad. We define a tetrad field at each point of the space time, and this the choice of this tetrad field is a gauge choice. And it turns out that if you take p mu nu plus the time component of this tetrad field, that gives you the spin supplementary condition. It's not clear to me what is the physical meaning of this, but this is the only spin supplementary condition which gives a canonical commutation relations for the spin.
And the dots in that equation are not with respect to the proper time.
They are respect to this preferred slicing we okay. take. They're not their coordinate time. So we have a three-dimensional Hamiltonian, which depends on HI, the spatial coordinate. It's a three-dimensional Hamiltonian. It's not a four-dimensional Hamiltonian. We can talk later about the spin supplementary.
What is the time of slicing?
Second.
What is the time of slicing? Yeah.
Well, it's a coordinate. I mean, you can change that time slicing.
I say it's an arbitrary time.
Yeah, it's arbitrary. Yes. But you want to introduce a time slicing in post-Newtonian theory because we want. I mean, you can also use this this Hamiltonian. You can expand in post-Newtonian theory. So we wanted to check that our Hamiltonian was the same, coincided at certain post-Newtonian level with the post-Newtonian Hamiltonian. That's why we introduced the time slicing, essentially. Okay. So if you do this, you can implement the UB recipes if you have this Hamiltonian. This is essentially what we did in the next years, in 2008, 2011. So as I said, the UB model. Has different ingredients. It has the deformation for the Kerr black hole. It has, you have to specify what the mappings of the Kerr black hole and the spin of the particle are. So we express these quantities in terms of the spins of the real black holes that we want to use and that we want to describe. And on top of this, the UB model also has three parameters in the conservative sector because we don't know post-Newtonian theory up to arbitrary order. So these three parameters describe the uncertainties in the higher order post-Newtonian order that we don't know. If we knew post-Newtonian theory up to an arbitrary level, we wouldn't have three parameters. So what we try to do is to calibrate these three parameters against numerical relativity simulations because we know that numerical relativity is the correct answer to the two-body, correct solution to the two-body problem. And so we try to gain information about post-Newtonian theory using numerical relativity. And so this EOB model that we constructed contains all the information that we know so far about the conservative PN dynamics and also about the test particle limit because we started off from a Hamiltonian which describes the Papa-Petri equation. And on top of this picture, so far I only talked about the conservative dynamics. So the UB model also includes some prescription to calculate the waveforms. And this is the end product that we want to achieve. So during the inspiral of the effective particle, so for separations larger than the effective disk of the system, we used post-Newtonian waveforms. And this described the spiral very well. When the plunge of the effective particle happens, we correct post-Newtonian waveforms, which are usually calculated for circular motion. We include some radial corrections that describe the plunge. And in the final part, when the effective particle crossed the potential barrier, the effective potential barrier, the light ring, we describe the final black hole product that you produce by means of a superposition of quasi-normal modes. And I'm very late, so I'll go very fast, but because these are, if you want, technical details. So for the, these are the waveforms that we use for the inspirals. We use post-Newtonian waveforms. Again, we know post-Newtonian waveforms only up to a certain PN order, so we have one free parameter in the dissipative part of the model. We calculate the gravitational wave energy fluxes that drive the evolution of the binary using the post-Newtonian waveform. So from this point of view, the model is self-consistent. Whereas in the plunge, we multiply the post-Newtonian waveforms, which are for circular orbits, by some factor which essentially introduces radial corrections in order to describe the plunge. And these coefficients, which describe the plunge, are essentially read off from numerical relativity simulations. So there are three parameters of the system, but three parameters that we can actually calculate very easily once we have accurate numerical relativity waveforms.
But so you, those parameters depend on mass ratio and spin.
Yeah, so we fit, so yeah, so what we did was to collect numerical relativity simulations for various mass ratios and spins, and we fitted the results. So we have, so essentially the knowledge of these parameters is equivalent to knowing the maximum amplitude, the frequency at the peak of the amplitude, and the derivatives. So we can extract these quantities very easily from the data and fit them as function of mass ratio and spin. So
you're restricting yourself to the L2 model?
I'm sorry?
Are you restricting yourself to the L2?
I'm restricting myself to what?
To the L2 model?
No, no, with this, yeah, this is just for, we have different coefficients for the other modes.
So every mode would have?
Yeah, its own.
Well, then you have a finite number of modes.
Well, you have an infinite number, but only a finite number is what you need, because usually the dominant mode is the 2-2, and the other are subdominant.
So you fit for like.
We usually only fit so far. We looked mainly at the 2-2 mode, and in some cases I'll show results. We also looked at the higher order modes, but we mainly focused on the 2-2, which is why I wrote that formula. And finally, once we describe the ring down, we use a superposition of quasi-normal modes. And okay, so maybe I'll skip the details and go directly to the results. So just to sum up things, the UB model includes all the information we have from the test particle limit from post-Newtonian dynamics, and it has a number of free parameters which we try to fit against numerical relativity waveforms to gain information about post-Newtonian theory from numerical relativity. And these are some examples of what we get. These are Caltech-Cornell waveforms, produced by Harald Pfeiffer, actually, and his group, and other people at Caltech, but also by local people here in Toronto. And so this is you can't even see the difference between the EOB and the numerical relativity curve. This is a comparable mass black hole, comparable mass system with zero spins. And as you see, the EOB matches very well the numerical relativity waveform. And also, if we go to Q is the mass ratio, if you go to an unequal mass ratio, we still get a very good agreement between the EOB and the numerical relativity waveforms to within 0.1 radians when it comes to the mass error.
So you fix the parameters in one case and you use the same ones in the other?
Yeah, this is, well, these are waveforms we use to calibrate the final calibration of the model, but the parameters are, of course, the same for each one of these two, and also for all the next figures I'm going to show. This is, we also compare to Tarkovsky waveforms, so solutions are essentially of the linear approximation to GR. And this is what we get. These are waveforms produced by Scott Hughes. Again, in this case, we have a non-spinning black hole, mass ratio 10 to the minus 3. We still have some problem during the ring down, but this is pretty good, I think. And we also looked at the subdominant modes. This is the 3-3 mode, for instance. We also looked at the other subdominant modes, the 2-1 mode, the 4-4 mode. And again, we have always a few problems near the end, but still, this is a quite good description.
Subdominant, I mean, it's a factor of 3 only, right?
You know, 6 then, to respect to the 2-2 mode.
Yeah.
No, it's a factor of 10 to the minus.
It's the same case. Oh, and this one, what is the one in the left?
Sorry. Okay, 10 to the minus 3. Yeah, it's a factor of 10, I would say.
This one is 2-1 then? What is the one? No,
this is 2-2, this is 3-3.
And this is 2-2, the one in the left?
Yeah.
Okay. This is equal
mass? No, this is extreme mass ratio, Tarkovsky. Anyway, we also looked at spinning black holes, and this is the comparable mass case with spins pointing down. So angular momentum pointing up, spins pointing down, and again, we have very good agreement. We only looked at the dominant mode here. And this is for spins pointing up, and again, quite decent agreement.
But so, do you change the parameter amplitude of this final stitching?
Yeah, so we have a fit, an analytical fit, which prescribes what those coefficients, final stitching, are. So you mean the quasi-normal modes?
Right.
Quasi-normal, I didn't have time, but we simply impose continuity here at the top. And quasi-normal modes are dictated by continuity of the waveform. So we don't have freedom in order to specify the quasi-normal modes.
But so for each spin, you have to do that, or?
Yeah, so yeah, we solve the equations that to give continuity. We impose continuity and we solve for the coefficients of the quasi-normal modes. this is why we have these small disagreements, because this procedure is very simplistic. And we don't have freedom to change the coefficients of the quasi-normal mode, because there we want continuous, we actually impose C infinity or continuity up to set to high order. That we fix the, we fix the quasi-normal modes that way. And we also looked at the spinning case in the case of Tyokovsky waveforms. So again, very good agreement. And this for spins minus 0.5 and 0.5. And we also looked at very low spins, minus 0.9, so spin point down, pointing down, angular momentum pointing up, and spin 0.7, again, very good agreement. And I don't want to pretend that everything is perfect, because it's not. So one problem that we have is that our model can only handle spins that are lower than 0.7. So this is the case for minus 0.94. So this is a waveform which we didn't include in the calibration. So we tried to predict the waveform based on our UOB model and compare it to the numerical theory waveform. So this is kind of a blind test. And still we get very good agreement. We get a very small phase disagreement, but that's a pretty good result. But when we look at spin point 97, almost extreme black holes, we get something which doesn't work at all already during the spiral. And this is essentially because we don't know post-Newtonian theory at sufficiently high orders in the spin.
So that's what it means. So the red, which is hard to see, then you have a...
Well, you can look at the difference. This is the error in the frequency, in the dephasing, and it goes to 1 radian already during the spiral. So this is bad for us because we want to be very precise. So we want our error to be less than a radian. That's why we stop. And the other thing that we don't know how to do yet is how to include the self-force results. So we know how to include some of the self-force results, but not all of them. And we're working on that. And the other thing we don't know how to do is how to handle, we don't know how well our model works for precessing spins, because essentially because there are no waveforms that are sufficiently accurate to test our model to the degree that we want. And this is something which is, in any case, ongoing work. And there is a huge collaboration of numerical relativists to produce waveforms to test this very model that I presented.
Those papers should be out
right there. Yeah, they're writing the paper now. Well, I just wanted to say that the EOB idea, the fact of trying to map the one body, the comparable mass problem into a test particle problem, can also be applied to other fields, to other observables, for instance, the final mass and final spin of the black hole. So I wanted to talk you can cook up an EOB approach if you want to the final spin and final mass of a binary system, and if you compare to numerical relativity, you again get very good results. But let me move to the second part of the talk, because I want to say in the last 10 minutes, I want to talk about the evolution of black hole spins in a cosmological scenario. So as I said before, it doesn't make sense to study. One of the reasons why we want to include the spins of the black holes in the waveforms is because eventually we want to use the waveforms from LISA, for instance, to learn something about galaxy formation, because the black holes cannot be studied, black hole evolution cannot be studied independently of the evolution of their host galaxy. So if you know something about the spins of the black hole or the masses of the black holes, you know something about galaxy formation. The thing is, galaxy formation, however, is very difficult to simulate in full generality, because you need, if you wanted to simulate formation of galaxies on all scales, including the black holes, you would need to go from the megaparsec scale to the 10 to the minus 6 parsec scale, which are the scales of the horizon of the black hole. So what people do, they either have SPH simulations, which come along only some range of this system, or they use semi-analytical models. So what I used to tackle this problem is to write a semi-analytical galaxy formation model in which I have different components for the galaxy. So this is a cartoon of what my model looks like. So I have a dark matter halo, which extends on hundreds of kiloparsec scale or even megaparsec scale, filled with some hot gas, which is unprocessed gas at the virial temperature, essentially. On smaller scales, I have a galactic disk.
So the blue particle, the dark matter, and the white, this gas, or is it that?
Yeah, this is not my drawing. I just took it from the internet. Yeah, I think these are supposed to be dark matter particles. And then you have, on smaller scales, you have a bulge, a spheroid, made of gas and stars. On even smaller scales, you'll have your black hole binary or your black hole surrounded by an accretion disk, and so on and so forth. So I have all these components in my model. So I have, very briefly, I have dark matter. I use a Press-Schecter merger tree to describe galaxies. So I start off with galaxies that are very small. And then when you increase the time, they merge together, and eventually you'll get just one. And this is the skeleton of the model and describes dark matter. And then I have, as I said, the hot gas, this red thing I have in there. So I describe that with some semi-analytical prescription. So I don't want to enter into the details here. The only thing I want to say is that this hot gas, at some point, will cool down. So when the hot gas cools down, of course, you will not have any pressure support anymore. So this hot gas, when it cools, will create a galactic disk. Because essentially, if the gas cools down, you don't have anything preventing collapse in this direction, but centrifugal force will still be there because the halos are moving. So you still have centrifugal force, so you format a galactic disk. And this is the smaller structure that you can see here. And this, again, I describe, and this is a picture of what a real disk galaxy looks like. And these galactic disks, I describe again semi-analytically. So I have star formation in these galactic disks. I have AGN feedback in these galactic disks. And then I have inside this galactic disk, I have this spheroidal component, which is observed in real galaxies like the Sombrero galaxy here. And again, I consider star formation in this galactic bulge. And I consider also AGN feedback. And then, of course, in my model, galaxies merge. And this is a picture of what a real galaxy merger is like, because this is actually an actual observation from the Hubble Space Telescope. So I describe galaxy mergers in my model. I include the effect of dynamical friction. So the two galaxies, when they get very, they are initially drawn together by dynamical friction. And eventually they merge. So I distinguish between major mergers in which the galaxies are comparable mass or minor mergers in which they're not comparable mass. And major mergers are thought to disrupt the disk structure of galaxies and form the spheroidal components, whereas minor mergers are thought to leave the disks untouched. And of course, in my model, I also want to include some description of the jets and of the black holes, because these are what couples the evolution of the black holes to the evolution of the galaxies. So I have a model for the seeds of the massive black holes. So I start with very small masses for the seeds, but this is in detail. The important thing I want to say is that I have accretion. I have a quasar accretion phase in my models. And I talked in the beginning about the Bardeen-Peterson effect. So the way I implement accretion in my model is by actually exploiting the Bardeen-Peterson effect. So if my black hole lives in a gas-rich environment, the Bardeen-Peterson effect essentially aligns the accretion material on the equatorial plane of the black hole. So in a gas-rich environment, sorry, the other way around. So the accretion disk aligns the black hole with its orbital angular moment. So accretion is always prograde in the case of a gas-rich environment. Whereas in a gas-poor environment, matter comes onto the black hole from all directions. And the black hole, because the matter is very feeble, doesn't have a lot of angular momentum, the black hole doesn't align its orbital angular momentum with the incoming mass. So essentially, in a gas-rich environment, I have coherent accretion. And in a gas-poor environment, I have chaotic accretion because of the Bardeen-Peterson effect. And this is important when it comes to the spin evolution, because coherent accretion tends to spin the black holes up, because matter comes with a fixed angular momentum.
But unless you lose a spin via jets.
I'm sorry?
Unless you lose
the spin. Yeah. Well, but the power that you emit in jets, it depends. If in some scenarios, like this magnetically arrested accretion disks, you can lose a significant spin through jets. That's true. Whereas in chaotic accretion, because matter comes with random direction of the angular momentum, you tend to spin the black holes down. Well, I also have radio accretion modes in my model, and these are essentially responsible for the emission of jets. So I have some semi-analytical prescription for what luminosity goes away in the jet, and these are taken from numerical simulation, I think Meyer et al. 2001. Maybe Lewis has something better, but these are very simple luminosities, expressions for the luminosity. They depend on the spin of the black hole, and they depend on the geometry of the accretion. So if you have another essentially spherical accretion, you emit much more energy in jets than if you have thin disk accretion. And finally, the last ingredient of my model are black hole mergers. So I evolve the black holes through the mergers. So I calculate what the final spin, final mass, and kick velocity of the binary is after a merger. I use some semi-analytical formulas, which people proposed in the literature, including myself. And I also compared the kick velocity.
I think there are probably 5 models out there.
Yeah.
And the only 2 that are missing here is the people are in the audience.
I'm sorry, yeah. I prepared these slides. Yeah, no, you do have a formula for final spin and the mass. I just forgot to edit.
So,
well,
we don't have mass.
So, who's missing? It's Leighton, and you.
And
Kesten.
And Mike Kesten, yes.
Is that a separate model as well?
It's an improvement over. Well, Kesten is with him, and then the one we had, Kesten improved.
Yeah, so but the thing I wanted to talk about was not the formulas, but the fact that here again, the Bardeen-Peterson effect plays a role. Because if you do have Bardeen-Peterson effect, so if you have a lot of gas in galactic centers, the spins are going to be aligned. And if you don't have a lot of gas, you expect isotropic distribution for the spins. And therefore, you'll have a different spin evolution or mass evolution for the black holes. So what I do, I distinguish between these 2 scenarios. I distinguish between wet mergers and dry mergers, and in which case I assume alignment of the spin. In the other case, I assume isotropic orientation or isotropic distribution for the spin. I also check if the kick velocity of the black hole exceeds the escape velocity from the galaxy. So we're running out of time, so I'll skip the calibration of the model. And go straight to the results. So this is the spin evolution for different seed models, but you just can just look at one of the 2 pictures, whichever you prefer. So I have on the x-axis the mass of the black hole, and in the y-axis the spin. And the color code is the density of black holes. So when you're at high redshift, your galaxy has a lot of gas, because black holes haven't sterilized the galaxy through AGN feedback yet. So accretion emerges. In accretion emergence, the Bardeen-Peterson effect is very efficient, and you expect, therefore, high spins because accretion tends to be coherent, and mergers tend to be spin-aligned. As you increase cosmic time, you start, this is z equals 6, z equals 5, z equals 4, you start seeing the presence of a second peak for the spin distribution around very low spins. And this is because black holes are starting to sterilize the galaxy through jets. So the eject mass, eject gas from the galaxy. The galaxy becomes more and more gas poor. And so accretion and merger starts to be chaotic. And therefore, you start, your distribution is skewed towards lower spins. And this is what the distribution looks like at z equals 2. Z equals 1, z equals 0.5, z equals 0. So at z equals 0, you have generically very small spins. Now, this is the prediction of the model. So you might ask, what is this consistent with data? Depends what data you look at, as often with these kind of things. So this is some, recent paper last year in which these people try to estimate the efficiency of the quasar, versus cosmic time, versus redshift. And the efficiency, I think this is the efficiency tends to drop at recent times. Because as I was saying in the first slide, the efficiency of an accretion disk is connected to the spin. This means that according to this data, you have lower spins at recent times, which would seem to be in agreement with the
I mean, before making a comparison, there are lots of free parameters in these constructions.
I have 4. I have 4, and I calibrate them against observation.
Four for just the spin up or the spin down, but I mean the whole merger rate, accretion rate.
No, but I have
and all of those stuff.
So I mainly have 4 free parameters. I have the supernova feedback efficiency, whatever that means, the AGN feedback efficiency, another parameter, and some time scale for the black hole accretion.
Okay.
And these I fit to a number of observations at z equals 0 and z higher than 0. So I have four parameters, and I try to reproduce all this data: stellar mass, baryonic, stellar and baryonic mass function, gas fraction, star formation rate, black hole mass function, morphologies, M sigma, and Magaurian relation at z equals 0, quasar luminosity function, star formation history. So yeah, it's true. I have some free parameters. I could have more if I wanted.
But you pen that down only four of them.
Yeah, I change only four. Others I put to some value that seems reasonable, and I don't change it anymore. Otherwise, you'll never finish.
Wait, okay, let me say you can follow
this. Yeah, and I fit this. Oh, well, I try to find a fit that explains more or less all the some of the data that we know about galaxies. The other thing that you could do is would be to use RMK alpha lines, but to measure the spins, and I think we have 20 measurements, but it's still uncertain whether IronK alpha lines are a good measurement of the spin. Some people claim they are. There are different groups, for instance, that measure the spin of the same object, and sometimes they don't agree with very large errors. But I'm not claiming that you shouldn't believe relativistic IronK alpha lines. I'm just saying that we should have gravitational wave detectors, because gravitational wave detectors will measure actually the spins of all the black holes in the universe. So with my model, I also try to calculate how many mergers per year of observations you have as a function of a redshift for different seed models in order to calculate how many events you would have, for instance, for LISA. And my model confirms that LISA should be able to see between a few and a few hundred of events per year when it comes to massive black hole mergers. And another thing, that another prediction I can make for LISA is that...
There's a supermassive black hole.
Second?
Supermassive.
Supermassive black holes, yeah. All these are for supermassive black holes. And another thing I can predict is how many mergers happen in gas-rich environments or gas-poor environments, because LISA will be able to tell those, because if you see the spins are aligned, the spins will be aligned. That will mean the merger was wet, whereas if a merger happens in a gas-dry environment, the spins will be randomly oriented. So I have predictions for the fraction of gas-rich mergers as function of a redshift for different mass ranges. And this is something, again, LISA could be able to measure.
So what do you do with the last parsec problem?
I just ignore that.
Nobody
knows how. Well, I mean, there are proposals to solve the final parsec problem.
But you're saying it's assuming that somehow they do merge.
Yeah, so I assume the scale. So if you want, I track the evolution of a binary of galaxies, of two galaxies, under dynamical friction. So I can tell when the two galaxies merge. By that time on, I assume the black holes merge instantaneously, because if you believe one of these proposals to solve the final parsec problem, the black holes would merge very quickly after the two galaxies merge. So from my point of view, it's a good approximation to assume that they merge when the galaxies merge. If you don't solve the final parsec problem, you would observe no black hole mergers whatsoever. But that would be a problem for galaxy formation as well.
But, I mean, wouldn't that matter for this fraction of wet mergers, for example? Because
I mean, if you don't solve the final parsec problem, you'll not have any mergers at all.
Well, but I mean, couldn't wet mergers don't have a final parsec problem
dry mergers. Among the proposals you have in a gas-rich environment, the viscosity could have to solve the final parsec problem, but also in dry mergers, the triaxiality of the galaxies.
That could change this ratio, basically, right?
That would do what?
That could change this ratio. You said you have a fraction of that merger. So
if you have a different way to solve the final parsec problem for dry and wet mergers, yes, that is
true. Limited.
Yeah. Yeah, but I'm not sure what is the time scale predicted by the triaxiality. That is much larger than what is, I mean, my impression is that both would predict a very small time, but that's a good point.
Enrico, when you use your model to predict the number of binaries of PTA, would
see? Yeah, in principle, yeah. Some people use similar models to do that. Marta Volontari, she tries to compare two data for dual AGNs, and also you can principally use it for PTA. And I also predict the mass ratios of the binary, but I'll skip that. And this is something that LISA can measure, the mass ratio of binaries. So in conclusion, spins have major effects in the strong field dynamics and in the waveforms from black hole binaries. And I think including the effect of the spins in the wave function is important because they provide a genuine strong field test of gravity. So they test the spin orbit coupling. And in particular, what I try to do is to use similar analytical methods, and the EOB is one of them, to include information from all we know about, from all the methods we can use to learn about the spin in binaries. So from PN theory, numerical relativity, and the self-force formalism. And in the second part of the talk, I try to convince you that it doesn't make sense to study massive black holes in isolation if you want to study their spin evolution and mass evolution, because you need to study also the evolution of the co-evolution of black holes and their host galaxies, because you have, on the one hand, the galaxy provides fuel for the black hole to grow, and on the other hand, the black hole exerts feedback on the evolution of the galaxy. And in particular, the claim I made is that we should expect high spins and gas-rich spin-aligned mergers at redshift larger than 3 when galaxies are gas-rich, whereas at smaller redshift, if I had to guess, I think LISA will detect low spins and dry mergers because the galaxies have been sterilized by the AGN feedback. And among the other things, I was able to confirm that LISA should see at least a few events per year and should also be able to test directly the massive black hole gas interaction or the Bardeen-Peterson effect by looking at the fraction of spin-aligned binaries. And that's all I want to say, and thanks. Yep.
So, can you comment on this paper by Pretorius and Ostreicher that claims that, I mean, essentially going through, I assume, a similar model?
Pretorius and Ostreicher?
The imminent detection.
I'm sorry?
The imminent detection by PTA.
What is that
called?
I
don't know the paper.
So it's just that they essentially do the same thing. I said based on current model of gas formation, you should have already seen gravitational waves in pulse of Manica, right?
Not already. No, they claimed in 2015.
Oh, no. I thought the paper says that you should have already seen it now that you don't see it in those constraints. I mean, maybe you're talking about a different paper, but there's...
What is the imminent detection? Or
well, that, I guess imminent is just saying that you should have already seen it if you haven't. But if you haven't seen it, it should be very, very close. But I remember that's what the paper said.
I know the PTA.
Well, the traditional argument, the traditional estimate was that the numbers are they get higher rates because of what changes.
No, I think the paper said that if we haven't seen it, then it's already telling us something.
Let's see, we calculate the merger and find that the merger
I don't know.
Okay, so the gravitational merger of 3 to 500 is stronger than estimated.
So that may be already detected with existing data.
May already be detected with existing data from 3
to 500, and what's the
I think it's the same thing that Enrico was talking about.
So they say which models they use to calculate this event rate?
They assume.
So recent observations of massive galaxies indicate that they double in mass and
quintupling size between redshift 1 and horizon.
So basically based on some
the mass function of galaxies. It's not even a model, it's from data.
So you said the merger rate is 10 to 20 times higher.
Right, but then...
So kind of, you need some modeling to reconstruct the mass function of galaxies.
But yeah, but in this...
It's more direct than what I do.
The CIPAR meeting, Mr. Pini was saying that they put this paper in October or something, and then 2 months later were new observations of the same systems arguing that no, that was way too optimistic.
It's not as high as
Well, also, I would say that actually the rate of double AGNs or double binaries with the certain separation depends on the details of the final parsec problem solution. Because if you have a bottleneck,
but I guess that's one of the loopholes. I mean, if you don't have any mergers, then of course you're not going to see anything.
Yeah.
Right?
No, but also, I mean, if the binary evolution stalls at one parsec, then you'll have plenty of binaries at one parsec and none at lower. So maybe that's, and I think at one parsec, I don't know how many parsecs away can the PTA detect that?
With pulse mass?
It depends on the mass. What fraction of the predicted number are actually in a parsec?
Exactly, yeah. So can the PTA detect, is the frequency sufficient to be in PTA window if separation is a parsec?
No, I think that's only the only like most massive black holes are going to be orbiting fast enough that when they're separated by a parsec. What is it?
So 10^9.
Can we just, does anyone know? Let's just, can we just use Kepler's law for a minute here? I know one 10^8 hertz.
Okay. 10^8 or minus 8?
Minus 8.
That makes sense.
The Earth rotates once per year, the Sun, one, so, yeah, sorry. So the ratio, we need the ratio of 1 AU, yeah, it's all you. The ratio of 1 AU to 1 parsec.
Mm-hmm. Oh, in terms of?
ASAP.
No, what is the units you want
to? I want the ratio.
Oh, that's
10
to the 5,
distance.
Yeah.
10 to the 5,
yes,
okay, so. That's right.
Yeah.
10 to the 5, and then, okay. And
nice.
the ratio of 1 year to 10^-8 hertz.
But that's the same. That's one, right?
Yeah.
Well, how about the?
That's 10.
Yeah, yeah, 10. Okay.
Okay. So, so Kepler's law says mass over omega squared goes mass over a cubed. So if we want to scale a up by 10^5, we would have to, and we scale m up by 10^9. They're orbiting too slow at one parsec.
Okay. So the separation is
a little bit smaller.
Smaller.
The tenth of a parsec. The answer.
Yeah. So if you have the yeah, so the final parsec problem could be why you don't see it.
But I guess that's fine. But I mean, I think it's important for you to come because I mean. Compare your scenario, at least same with PTA.
Yeah,
that's very interesting. I guess the only thing you worry about is that there's so many assumptions you have to make.
I'm still working on this and try to. Well, the only thing you can do is try different prescriptions for it. For instance, accretion, trying to relax and see how the results change. Because I assume chaotic accretion, what I'm trying to do is the galaxies, we know galaxies rotate, so they have a preferred direction. So accretion can't be completely chaotic, even in gas drying
environment. But I mean, the other thing is, I mean, the thing you mentioned about magnetically arrested disk, that I feel that kind of turns the picture upside down, and maybe you do have chaotic accretion.
Yeah, that's what the other thing. Yeah, I'm actually talking to Sasha Chekoskoy to include, because it's very simple. I mean, whenever the Eddington ratio is above 30%, then you essentially spin the black, spin down. Yeah, so you would have, I think my results would change in the sense that all the redshift you would have small spins. I think that's what would happen.
Yeah.
I just want to modify my answer. So even if it's 0.1, even if they get down to 0.1 parsec, you still need to have a 10^10 solid mass black hole.
Okay.
There was a fame of 10^10.
Yeah, that's pretty rare. Yeah.
That just one, like, you need to but no, I guess even...
You need the total mass to be 10.
Well, I guess, yeah, mine is fine, yeah. Yeah, mine is fine. Okay, fine.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
So, Enrico is going to be here tomorrow with Italia.
Yeah.
Back to France to enjoy...
Actually, I'm heading to DC.
Ah, you're going to DC?
From spring, yeah.
France, I will be surrounded by French.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.